History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions, and then be patient enough to listen as memories from long ago take on new life in the here and now. The idea, first and foremost, is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It's hard to believe that 4th of July weekend is here already. This Independence Day marks birthday number 246 for America. We live in challenging times, there's no doubt, but there have been plenty of challenging periods through those 246 years, and there is still so much for us to be thankful for. There are also many different ways to celebrate the holiday, and I'm sure you have many choices wherever you're listening from today. While many museums close for the holiday, there's an aircraft carrier in California's Bay Area that's an exception to that rule. The USS Hornet Sea, Air, and Space Museum in Alameda, California will be open from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. on the 4th. There's plenty of free parking. They'll have a DJ that day, some special food and drink for the occasion, and so much history to explore aboard that historic ship. I have a link to the details online for you at hometownheroesradio.com. The success of Top Gun Maverick in theaters has a lot of people coming to the Hornet to see an F-14 and to see the ship where much of the original Top Gun was filmed. And there's a lot more I learned about this historic vessel in a serendipitous tour, some of which connects to some of your favorite hometown heroes you've met on this program over the years. Let's learn a little more from one of the Hornet's many volunteers, Cynthia Savoy. How long have you been volunteering here on the Hornet?
9 years.
What was it that hooked you in? Why do you do this?
For the love of the ship, the love of the military, and the history of the Hornet.
Give me a taste of that history of the Hornet. Why should people come see this piece of living history?
We are the most decorated ship in Navy history for World War II. We shot down more planes, sunk more ships than any other vessel. We also are the historic site for the Apollo 11, first man to walk on the moon. This ship actually recovered the astronauts when they came back from the moon.
And you're wearing a NASA hat right now. I'm thinking that's something you've always been interested in, the space race and NASA and getting to the moon and other places?
Correct. I've always watched every shuttle take off on the NASA channel, if it was usually taped or I could see it live. But as a kid, I used to go to the planetarium in New York by myself and just admire the space program and the evolving of it.
And is there a military connection in your family that maybe inspired some of this? Or what was it that really said, hey, Cindy, you need to go do this?
Well, my father was in World War II in the South Pacific. And also, I grew up near the Brooklyn Navy Yard, where I could see ships being built and I could go visit because a lot of my family worked there as a kid.
And did your father ever tell you much about what he did in World War II?
Only the recreation part, playing soccer and things like that. But he never referred to what he actually witnessed as a soldier.
Which is very common. But now you know the history of this ship in World War II and beyond. You just gave us a little bit of the track record in terms of the decorations. But if people are to come here to Alameda and come aboard the Hornet, what are they going to see? What should they be looking for?
Well, as soon as you come on, you're going to see something called the hangar deck. The hangar deck actually has historic airplanes and helicopters on the hangar deck. We have a replica of the bomber that George H. Bush was shot down in World War II and was actually recovered. That's how he became president. He was very famous. Also, we have the Wildcat, which is an excellent plane that was in the bottom of Lake Michigan for many years because they used it for practicing takeoff and takeoff and touchdown in Lake Michigan. And we were able to get one of the last ones from salvage, and we restored it here on the ship. We also have the helicopter that picked up the astronauts, 11, and that's called a Sea King. So you have to come and see all these wonderful planes and helicopters that we have here stored and have been restored by our great restoration crew.
Had you ever been on an aircraft carrier before you started volunteering here?
No.
What was the most surprising thing to you that maybe you didn't expect to learn about what it's really like aboard an aircraft carrier?
Wow. There's a lot of, actually, it's everything. As soon as I came on, I was amazed at this, at how large it was, what it had to offer history-wise, and also the volunteers that are here. They are definitely dedicated to the ship. Restoration, the docents, security, everyone on this ship is dedicated, and we love volunteering to give our time and give everyone the history of the ship and what it was like to be a sailor on the ship, either a ranked officer or enlisted men. You will come and see where the enlisted men ate and slept and where the officers ate and slept.
And right now, I mean, we're standing right next to the captain's chair where he would have been in the South Pacific or anywhere around the world during the Hornet service years. We can see the flight deck. We can even see the catapult tracks still there that launched so many planes off this historic deck. For people that want to get involved, what's your advice to them? What are the different ways they can get involved to maybe explore more of the Hornet and partner with you and your fellow volunteers in what you're doing?
The best way is to go to our website, and that will give you all the information to volunteer and donations, and also special events. New Year's, we have one of the largest New Year's Eve parties in the Bay Area, and also our Monster Bash Halloween, one of the largest Halloween parties in the Bay Area.
And when people think the East Bay, when they think Alameda, when they think USS Hornet, it's Navy, 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 Navy. But there is some other history aboard this ship that you were kind enough to show me, and we had some mutual friends that are a part of that exhibit. You have a Nisei Veterans exhibit here on the ship. Tell me about that. Why is that important, and what do you hope people see and grasp and glean when they have a chance to visit that?
Well, the Nisei exhibit is dedicated to our veterans, Japanese Americans, second generation Japanese Americans that fought for our country while their families were in internment camps following Pearl Harbor. It has so much rich history, and the exhibit is very, very good. Our docents have taken a lot of time to put it together, and you'll learn about the process that the veterans went through while their families were in internment camps and they were fighting in the European theater for our country. And we also see how many decorations they have, Purple Hearts, Medals of Honor. It's a great place to visit. Also about the military intelligence service, who are important in breaking the code in the South Pacific and China during World War II. Very important in winning the war.
And each room, it's part of that Nisei exhibit, is dedicated to a different American veteran of Japanese ancestry. And one of those is the Lawson Sakai room. And Lawson told his story on this program. Some of our listeners remember that. Sounds like you got to know him quite well. What was it about Lawson and his story that made such a powerful impression on you?
Lawson was generous with giving me information personally about his experience in the 442. He was just dedicated in processing and giving information and teaching the history of the 442, what it was like firsthand to fight for our country. And he has four Purple Hearts, and also he had the biggest heart there is. You have to come and visit and read about him and what he did and what all of his fellow veterans did for the 442. It has four rooms dedicated to different historic information from the second that they were boot camp till the end of World War II. So come visit.
Yeah, and there are different aspects of those displays. There's a couple different videos they can watch that have interviews with Japanese American veterans. And I'm curious for you, you know, just because I know you knew Lawson so well, was there a particular element of his story and hearing him tell it that just really grabbed you, that said, boy, I can't imagine being in his shoes when that was happening?
Yeah, there are two. One is the Lost Battalion saving the 141 Texas National Guard. That was very historic as far as their accomplishments in saving this group of Americans from the Germans. And also the liberation of Bruges, France, where they were instrumental in saving that town. Every 4 years, they celebrate their liberation by their military armament coming out with jeeps and tanks and other vehicles. And they would have the American flag on one side and the French flag on the other side. And Lawson was the MC for many years. And he tells you so many good things about what the 442 accomplished in the European theater.
And Why, in your mind, I mean, you know it as well as anybody because you spent so much time in there and you've met so many of these gentlemen. Why, in your mind, is it so important to preserve that kind of history?
So it doesn't happen again.
The Japanese internment, or to put it maybe a little more completely, the forced removal and incarceration of roughly 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry is something we definitely don't want to see happen again to any group of people. I never expected to find such an extensive display of that history here on an aircraft carrier, but I'm sure glad I did, thanks to Cindy. And we're going to dive into some of the stories of the men honored here in a moment, but one more question for you first. How long are you going to keep doing this? I mean, you even dragged your husband Leroy into it. How long are you guys going to be out here?
Until we can't. So we plan on being here for many years.
Well, maybe you'll catch Leroy and Cindy on the 4th of July when the Hornet is open from 10 to 5, or next weekend, July 9th, when the museum holds a live aboard overnight adventure. On July 23rd, Pearl Harbor survivor Mickey Gannich, one of our all-time favorites here on Hometown Heroes, will be memorialized on the carrier. And that night, on Saturday the 23rd, the Hornet hosts an Apollo 11 splashdown and space exploration event. You can find info on all of those at uss-hornet.org. And I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. But for the rest of today's program, I want to explore some of that history I was surprised to find, captured so extensively and so well aboard the Hornet there in Alameda, the Nisei Veterans Exhibit. The first of four rooms you'll enter there captures what happened in the wake of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And here's a firsthand account from one of the Hornet's favorite Nisei vets, Lawson Sakai.
We were actually 7 miles from downtown Los Angeles City Hall. I walked it one time, and there was a lot of open land between where we were and downtown L.A., not like it is today. But we had 5 acres, which, you know, it was a small greenhouse-type flower industry, but it was in a nice location and easy to get to market. So we also farmed 13 acres quite a ways away out in the country, and we called it Blue Hills in those days. Currently, it's a country club near La Habra. All that farmland, there were no roads, just dirt roads that we drove on. And there were maybe 7 or 8 Japanese families farming chunks of land, various things. And we were also farming there. So my summers were spent on the farm. Growing up through the Depression years, of course, everybody had to do something because, you know, there was tough going in the late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah, what do you remember about those times? And what about your family? Did you have brothers and sisters?
I had one older sister. We really were a very small family. Most of the families, Japanese families, had 5, 6, 7, 8 children. They had big families, and they're farmed a little bigger. But in our case, we were very small, and I think it was sufficient. I used to help my father whatever I could. I was going to school, so I couldn't help him very much. But the whole Japanese community, and they used to get together for their own parties, but they couldn't associate with anybody else. Number one, they didn't speak the language. And number two, the other people didn't want the Japanese to mingle with them. But they were becoming the best and biggest farmers, best and biggest flower growers, the best and biggest fishermen. They had a huge fishing fleet at Terminal Island. My uncle was driving a Chrysler Airflow around, which was the car in, 1938-9.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of business jealousies and so forth, and a lot of pressure on the politicians to remove the Japanese, which was the talk, was send them to Japan, after Pearl Harbor, ship them all to Japan, whether they're American citizens or not. And they possibly could have if they wanted to, I'm sure. They put 120,000 into camps.
Yeah.
It wouldn't take much more to start putting them on ships and sending them out. So that was kind of the rumor going around. But
even before Pearl Harbor, I'm interested in your experience, because clearly that was a differentiating point. But I understand you were a pretty good athlete. You played high school football and basketball, even some in junior college?
It was war years. I weighed 140 pounds.
Yeah.
I played a running guard at Compton Junior College. I graduated high school in 1941.
Mm-hmm.
So in September, I went to Compton Junior College, and the ranks were depleted, let's say. So I got to play second string football.
Mm-hmm.
And I also played baseball later before I left California. But
had you ever faced any kind of discrimination in school? Being Japanese American?
Very little. Nothing really to speak of, because the teachers were good. Almost all of my friends, the students, were all good. When I went, of course, I knew almost everybody at Montebello High School. When I went to Compton, I knew maybe one other person, maybe two. I didn't know anybody else. They're all strangers, but we all got along fine. Mm-hmm. Really had a good time there. The coach, Ed Suggett, used to kid me a lot. He said, when Japan attacks California, he says, are you going to attack me?
But I imagine that December 7th really changed your life. That's probably a pretty memorable day.
It didn't affect me as a student. The other students didn't say, what the hell's going on or anything. They, you know, it just, I don't think it affected them as students, and they never passed it on to me. I got along fine before and after Pearl Harbor. The only thing, of course, the newspapers, radio, and so forth, it's really gearing up for getting worse and worse every day.
And that day, specifically for you, December 7th, 1941, I like to ask every veteran this, Japanese American or otherwise, because they all seem to remember something. And do you remember that moment when you found out?
It was Sunday morning. I was doing homework. I was listening to my radio when the announcer broke in and said Pearl Harbor had been attacked. I didn't pay much attention to it because I really didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. Then as the news report kept coming on, it was like they would break in every 15 minutes or so and give you more information. Then, you know, it described how the battleships were being sunk and so forth. It was a pretty big deal. And then I realized how serious it really was. So it was kind of tough talking to my parents. They were working when they came in for lunch. You know, it was kind of, I broke the news to them and they were pretty shocked. They knew it was going to happen. Everything was pointing toward some kind of a confrontation. So I don't think they were surprised, but they were pretty disappointed that it did happen, because then now it's what's going to happen to us. You know, that was the thing. And then, of course, that afternoon, the FBI shows up and, you know, they take my uncle away. So,
and I want everyone to hear that, because I don't think people realize, especially people that weren't alive, this is really hard for them to fathom. The very day that Pearl Harbor happens, the FBI shows up and takes your uncle.
They took a lot of people on December 7th. They knew where everybody was.
And why do you feel that your uncle was targeted, that he was snatched
He
up?
Was the leader of the United Farmers Association, UFA, the largest produce market, 9th Street Market in L.A., a big wheeler dealer. So, you know, when they take the head, that leaves the rest of the body lifeless. Mm-hmm. And that's what they were doing. They were picking up whoever, teachers, lawyers, doctors, businessmen, anybody that they considered a leader of the community. They hauled them away, and that usually left people underneath who really were kind of helpless, and families. In most cases, the men in those days did everything. Mm-hmm. The mothers just raised the family and helpless.
Mm-hmm.
This is what happened. All this kind of crippled the Japanese families. So it made it easy for the U.S. government to take the next step, which was putting everybody into the American concentration camps mm-hmm. that were being built. at the same time.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, multiple perspectives on the most legendary achievement of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, the rescue of the Lost Battalion, which is captured extensively in the Nisei Veterans exhibit aboard the USS Hornet Museum in Alameda, California. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes on this Independence Day weekend. The USS Hornet Sea, Air, and Space Museum in Alameda, California, with an incomparable across-the-bay view of San Francisco's skyline, by the way, is going to be open 10 to 5 on the 4th of July. If you go, make sure you spend some time in the Nisei Veterans Exhibit, where the second room you'll step into is the Lawson Sakai Room, named for a veteran from the famed 442nd Regimental Combat Team who earned 4 Purple Hearts in World War II. We'll hear more of his memories in a bit. But right next to a photo of Lawson is a display honoring Medal of Honor recipient Joe Sakato, complete with these quotes from Joe. "Japanese ethnicity taught me to be strong," he said, "but first, I was an American." Here's some of Joe Sakato's story.
In France, we ended up in the near the Vosges Mountains of the Swiss border and the German border, foothills of the Swiss Alps, and climbing those hills is like 45-degree angle, and I had to pull on tree roots and pull myself up. Somebody else would take my pack, and somebody else. I was the last one up the hill. And when we got up top of the hill, this is going to be our first day of battle. And I was talking with one of my friends from Washington. We sat there, and we didn't know what incoming or outgoing was. When these veterans from the 442s of the 100 were fighting in Italy, they came back. I hear this. Oh. Then the guy says, "Oh, that's outgoing." Okay, next, we're talking around, and then pretty soon, boom. I pick myself up about 15 feet, 10 feet away. I got a nick in my wrist, and then in my foot, I had another nick. But I look down, and I see my friend laying down, face down, and I turned him over, and a shrapnel grazed his jugular vein. And the blood was squirting out every time his pulse would beat. So this stream of blood the size of a pencil would come out. And I'm trying to, my wound was nothing. So I was putting sulfur on his wound and put a pad on it and putting it too hard and he couldn't breathe. And I had to let go and blood was still squirting out. If I lost too much blood, he was the first to die on me.
And that was your very first day of combat?
First day of combat. The other veterans, they knew what's going on. But for me to get blown up and then see something, see my friend squirting blood, bleeding, I couldn't help him without choking him. And then I said, well, this is not for me. I don't know what I'm doing here. But we had to go. So we finally had to climb this hill and moving forward to town of Brewers, and the 3rd Battalion was down the bottom in the valley heading for Brewers, and then we heard house-to-house combat. They were fixed bayonets, So as we was marching towards the other end of the hill, the explosion goes off the top of the ridge that we were following, landmines. So we had to get on our stomach and pull out our bayonets and probe for landmines on it, inch by inch. What if I hit the trigger of the landmine? Holy mackerel. Boom. Another mine went off. Some at the top of the ridge. Well, we traveled on top of the ridge so we could look down to the left side and look down on the right-hand side. So as we traveled, they had these landmines put up. Then we finally got those out of the way, and then we got down to the end of the hill and we're looking down at this town of Brewers, and we see a tank, German Tiger tanks going out. Hooray, they're leaving. Then he got out in the middle of the field and he turns around, and that's funny, his barrel is facing us. And next thing I hear, boom. Then they see a ring of smoke on the end of the barrel of the tank, and then pow, hit the tree behind us. He was shooting at us. We had to run on the other side and try to dig in about 6 inches and hit tree roots and rocks. And I had to crawl into my helmet, and I said, what am I getting into now? Oh, my God. Then we finally took that hill, went to the next hill, took another hill, and we got another one. And we got up early in the morning, and they chased the Germans off this one hill. And I chased them all the way down to the bottom of the hill, and the sergeant says, come back. So I was heading back, and the German is shooting at me, and I'm shooting back at him. And then I go up, try to get back up the hill, and I go about 10 feet, and I got to rest. Go 10 more feet and rest. When I got on top of the hill, nobody was there. They thought I had joined them, and they all headed back downhill. Their eyes didn't know which way was our lines.
So you were all alone?
I was all alone by myself. And I got down, I got to the south end, the east end, left end of the hill, and I saw a big bush and 3 feet high, and I crawled inside that bush and put some branches on top of my face and nose. And I stayed there for a couple hours, and then German patrol comes by. Oh, my God. 2 more hours goes by. And it's now 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock. I see our helmet, and I said, hey, what company is this? The guy wanted to shoot me because I didn't know the password. He says, I've been up this hill for 6 hours, and I don't know where the password is now. The F company, so they took me back and got down. As soon as I got down the hill, got the rest of the company. Captain says, third platoon, you got to go up and see this colonel. Well, I just got to join the company. Well, you got to go. So we go up. One fellow was writing up a citation for that hill because we had taken that hill in 2 hours, an hour and a half. He was writing his third platoon. So he had to join us. He put all the information in his pocket, and we get up to see this colonel, and the colonel says he wanted to see where his men were. This is the 36th Division, Texas unit, and they was a Howley outfit. And we go out and see somebody chopping wood on this side of the hill, and somebody's chopping wood on the other side of the hill. And then we go up about 1,000 yards. Oh, sure enough, there's men were dug in the foxholes and everything. Then the lieutenant there says, go see where the Germans are at. Why should we go see where the Germans are? Why can't they go see where the Germans are at? They didn't have orders. What do you mean they didn't have orders? So we go up, go another 500 yards, and German machine gun. We hit the ground. I rolled over to the left, got behind a bush. Guy from Pueblo, Colorado was on my left side. He was out in the open. Ben Masoka was writing up a citation. He was on my right side of my... He was out in the open. And the guy named Friday on the other side of him, he was out in the open. George put up on our left side. He looked up, first one to get to. A sniper, German sniper, had telescopic sights with crosshair. Pow! Right through the temple. First one to go. Then Ben on the other side, he didn't have his helmet strapped on. Pow! He decreased his temple. Blood just coming out, and the helmet flew right way back. Then Friday, he looks up. He got shot. So all three guys got shot and looking for me, and I'm behind this bush and he couldn't see me. I had to go back, and I for just to see where the their own troops were. We had to go and find where the Germans were. We get shot. We lose three men just for nothing.
So it sounds like the message that you're getting is you guys were expendable.
That's what we were. General Dahlquist was, kept pushing. You got to move. You got to move. That's why the 141st unit of the Lost Battalion got surrounded, because they went too fast. They were moving too fast, and the rest of the 142nd and 43rd could not rescue them. So it was up to 442 to rescue the Lost Battalion. We're on this side of the hill. We'll cross the railroad tracks, and we get this order. They just pointed out that one hill, the 617. It's a big rocky ledge, cliffs, and then the rest of the mountain comes down. And we had to take that hill, and how are we going to get on top of that hill? He says, well, we go around it, but we have to chase the Germans off first. So we went on trucks, and we went behind the 7th Army, was fighting the Germans. And we went behind them and got on the back side of this hill. But we stayed on the west side of the hill down below, and at half step at a time we marched towards this cliff area. And when we took us all night to get up so far, we got to the area. At dawn, we started our attack. Now we were behind the Germans. We surrounded the Germans, and the Germans had to get out of their foxholes and went east to the east side. And then they joined the troops that was fighting the 3rd Battalion that was going into the valley. And we finally got them down and around there. We jumped. Then artillery came in, the Germans and artillery, and so we had to jump in the Germans' foxholes. And then we waited, and pretty soon the artillery stopped. They're going to be a counterattack. So the Germans called, radioed the troops that were fighting the 7th Army to come across, and they came across. Now they came in the same area that we had come in. Now the Germans were behind us. We were being surrounded again. They were trying to chase us out of their own foxholes. And we got off so far, and then I told one of the fellows, watch out for the machine gun. So he looks up and he says, where? And he got shot. When he got shot, I crawled over and picked him up, and he died in my arms. And I says, my God, I was going to get the SOB that shot him or else die trying. So I picked up my Thompson, and I crisscrossed up the hill. I went northeast one way, and then I fired. I had a Thompson submachine gun that I stole out of a Sherman tank that was crippled, and they were waiting for parts to fix it. But the troops that were from the tank were in the farmhouse talking to a farmer, and nobody was in the tank, so I crawled into the tank and pulled out the Thompson submachine gun and left my rifle. And then I was able to use it on this hill. When I fired it, it fired good straight up, and I says, oh, that's no good either. So I turned it on the side, and I started one left-hand side, and I, and it would automatically move to the right-hand side. That was real great. Mowed down a bunch of bushes, and next thing you know, I was going back and forth. When I go up to one, I fired it, and I turned it over again, and run up the other way, and then I was throwing it again. The Germans that were from the 7th Army didn't know about this rocky ledge. And then when they finally got to the top of the rocky ledge, they couldn't see where they could go around it, because the rest of the E Company was on the east side of it. They couldn't go there, so they dropped their rifles. I shot 6 of them, I know, but they said I shot 12 of them, and we captured 37 prisoners. They dropped their rifles because they couldn't get past that hill. And then therefore we came back, and we had to go to the left side hill. G Company moved over to the east end hills to chase the Germans off of the east hill down on the east side. And the 100th Battalion team came over and took over the hill 617, the east side of that hill, and then moved up towards the Lost Battalion. And the I Company was catching hell because they were getting shot from one hill and the other hill, crossfire. When they finally got to the Lost Battalion, 150 men, only 7 of them, I Company was able to walk. K Company had 17 men. 100th Battalion had 20 men. We had 30 Arthur, who was on the east side, we didn't get as bad as the others. I got wounded, and I was headed back to the aid station, and I'm the only one there going towards the aid station, and the Germans send up a mortar shell, lands up about 10 feet away from me and picked me up and blew me closer to the aid station. Then I was 3 months in the Epinal Hospital, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. And then they finally got me on a plane and went to England.
Some of the late, great Joe Cicatto's Medal of Honor story. He's one of the Nisei veterans honored in a special exhibit aboard the USS Hornet Museum in Alameda, California, which you can check out on the 4th of July or anytime it's open. And we'll try to bring a little more of that exhibit to life for you when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flat bed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, CVTR.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our focus today on the USS Hornet Sea, Air, and Space Museum in Alameda, California. And specifically, an exhibit I didn't know was there until a recent visit. The Nisei Veterans Display spans four rooms there and chronicles the 100th Battalion, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, the Military Intelligence Service, and every avenue of service for Americans of Japanese ancestry during World War II. You heard some of Joe Cicatto's Medal of Honor story, and I told you he's featured in the museum's Lawson Sakai room. But let's hear more from that room's namesake and get Lawson Sakai's memories from the 442nd's crowning achievement, the rescue of the Lost Battalion.
The weather was so bad, and of course we didn't have winter clothing, and we were soaking wet from the rain, and the hills were muddy. We're in the Vosges Mountains, the thickest forest that we'd ever been in. The Germans had the 88-millimeter anti-aircraft weapon, lowered it down, and started shooting it at the infantry. That sound of that 88 going off and exploding, that shrill sound coming, is something that I've never heard duplicated in movies or anything. It's just mind-shattering. And when it comes directly at you, wow, you know, it just, the sound itself is enough to blow you apart. But when it would hit these trees, branches would come off. Sometimes half of a tree would come falling, weighing maybe 1,000 pounds. A lot of guys got crushed. And the morning that I got hit, the 28th of October, we're going to mount a real strong attack at daybreak. And the Germans probably sensed that we were, because we had a big battle on the 27th. We gained the high ground. We dug in as best we could. That early that morning, the barrage came in, probably lasted 20, 25 minutes, maybe more. I don't know. Maybe 100 rounds, just bang, 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 just continuously. We were pinned down. You couldn't move. We had a lot of casualties right at that time. And, of course, when I got it, well, I thought I was dead. I was out of it. But
I imagine you had probably had some close calls before that.
Yeah, I got wounded twice in Italy. and then once before in France. So, but they weren't that bad, you know.
Well, define that, because you say, "Yeah, I got wounded once." Well, yeah, and most people have never been wounded, period. So when you say "weren't that bad," what do you mean?
You know, I got patched up, and I could go back a day or two. Mm-hmm. But the last time, the shrapnel that got me, in, if it came straight through, it would have blown a hole through me, but it came in at an angle, so it wrapped around in my ribs here. Oh, that was really painful. It just, you know, a red-hot piece of steel in there, and it just, your body just gives way. You just curl up, and you can't breathe, and I was sure I was dead. I remember I told the medic, just let me die right there. And he pumped me full of morphine, because when I woke up, I was on a train, on a litter. They were going to the American Hospital in Dijon, which is not too far away, for mm-hmm. surgery. And I don't know how I survived that one. But guys were getting killed left and right. You know, mostly the barrage from the artillery, just a awful shattering of not only the artillery shell, but the tree trunks and limbs coming down. In Italy, we had a few vineyards, a few olive orchards. Most of the hills were bare. Got to France and eastern France, and all of a sudden, this huge forest that we had to go through. The Germans were already entrenched, mm-hmm. dug in, so we had to go into the forest, dig them out.
You're going into a meat grinder.
Yeah.
What about your recovery? How long did it take to recover from those wounds?
About 3 months, but not too long after October 30, when the 211 men were rescued, Dahlquist pushed the 442nd for another 4 or 5 days before he let them come off the line.
Right.
We had so few men left. I think I Company had 8 out of 250 or so.
8 out of 250.
Yeah. I think our company, E Company, had probably the most. From what I heard, we had about 40 men left. But the 442nd really couldn't do much in it. They just depleted. So they were sent to southern France between Italy and France, and a hillside where, like the Maginot Line, they had fortresses built. And the duty was to guard the French-Italian border and the port cities of Cannes, Nice, and that area, patrol all of that. They called it the Champagne Campaign because there was very little battle going on. But there was a few. One of my friends, Sakamoto from the Valley, he got killed there. I think he's about the only one that was killed during that time. Mm-hmm. And the 442nd was there like from the middle of November till April. And that's a time when all these young kids, now the Army changed the designation back to 1A because of what the 442nd was doing. Mm-hmm. So they made them all eligible for the draft and were being drafted. And they were being trained at Camp Shelby. So after about 6 months, they were sent over, and they came in en masse to fill up the 442nd again.
Right. It needed a lot of filling up because of how devastated it was. With those 3 months of recovery for you, were there ever days where you weren't sure you were going to make it? Or you weren't sure you're going to be yourself again?
No, I was in good shape after the surgery. A little painful, of course, but... Mm-hmm.
Did you have broken ribs?
Nothing broke. It just... a lot of muscle tear, which is pretty bad.
And there are a lot of internal organs inside your rib cage. I mean, there's a lot of damage that could have been done there.
It didn't go in. It didn't come through. It went around. Mm-hmm. So it just, you know, just luck.
The angle was everything.
Yeah, just luck.
Was it luck or was somebody looking out for you?
I don't know. You see guys that... they get hit square in the head with a bullet. Oh, jeez. You know.
Well, here's the other thing that strikes me. Your injury, which almost killed you. I mean, we're talking inches probably from killing you. But had you not been wounded that day, 442 has a couple more days of combat before they liberate the Lost Battalion, and a lot more guys died in those two
days.
That's
right.
Is it possible that getting wounded when you did could have saved your life?
Very, very likely. From what some of the guys told me, the day that I got hit, after the barrage, they made their way forward, but they had a tough time. That was the 28th. The next save is the 29th. They could hear firepower, but it was not coming at them. So they knew that must be where the Americans were trapped because the Germans were shooting at them.
And one of those Americans in the Lost Battalion, part of the 36th Infantry Division's 141st Regiment, was a man who later on would become close friends with Lawson Sakai, Al Tortolano.
Oh, I don't know. It was almost like being reborn, I think, because you don't know what to think. You know, while you're there and the way things are going, your mind is first on your family. You know, will I ever see them again? What will happen? How will they take it, you know, knowing that I'm never going to come back. And it was just, I don't know, the feeling that we had. But then when we found out that they finally broke through, oh, man, it was like the sun coming out after a storm, you know. You figure it was 7 days of what we went through. It was really hell up there because we couldn't really dig in deep because it was mountain. You know, and there was a lot of rock and stuff. You couldn't really dig a foxhole. And even if you did, the tree bursts, you had to worry about tree bursts. You know, when all of a sudden we heard one guy say, oh, my God, we're fighting the Japs. Because we didn't even know at the time that there was a 442nd. Mm-hmm. And yet they were attached to our division at times. But we didn't even know, and that's why that's one guy that made that remark when we saw Japanese soldiers who were fighting the Japs. But then we found out they're our rescuers, and all we wanted to do was get out of there. And so we took off. I mean, we didn't stop to say thank you then or anything. All we wanted to do was get our butts off that mountain.
And I'm sure it wasn't until later that you realized the severe losses that they absorbed. They lost more men than they saved in terms of rescuing you. When you figured that out, how did that weigh on you? How did you process that, knowing that many men had sacrificed their lives for yours?
When I finally got to the, you know, really thinking about it, I know when they first rescued us, I was so happy and thankful. And then when we found out we didn't know until way later how many they actually lost. And I thought about it. I felt so bad because I said, here's a group of people that were used during the war. I don't know how to put it, but it seemed like when any dirty job had to be done or any fighting that they feel was almost impossible, the 442nd was always involved. Then I find out what their parents went through. And for them to volunteer to fight for their country like they did, I didn't know how to think about it. I just grab them and want to hug them, you know, and show them how you really felt about them.
You talk about wanting to hug them. I'm sure you've had the opportunity to meet some of the soldiers from the 442nd. What is that like for you? And is there anything that needs to be said? Is it a look in your eye, a hug, a pat on the back? Or have you had a chance to actually speak to them how much you appreciated them saving your life?
Oh, yes, I sure did. For about 8 years, I've been a volunteer up at the VA hospital in Palo Alto. Well, one day I'm driving the little shuttle around, and this Japanese-American, Lawson Sakai, says, are you Al Tortolano? And I said, yeah. He said, well, I'm Lawson Sakai. He says, somebody told me that you were driving. He said, I was with the 442nd. Oh, my God. He says, is there any chance we can get together and talk? I says, oh, yeah, yeah. So anyway, we started talking, and that's how I started getting involved with the 442nd. From there, they started inviting me to their different functions. I went to their reunions in Las Vegas as their guest. They made me an honorary member of the 442nd. And we got to swap stories, and I got to meet so many wonderful people.
And what does that do for you when you get a chance to talk to them and thank them? Do you feel like you're just speaking for yourself, or do you feel like you're speaking for all 220 guys who were saved by their brave actions?
Oh, no, I'm speaking for everybody. Yeah, because I know how they felt, not only speaking for those 220, I think I'm speaking for every other soldier that was in combat over there, thinking, man, if every division had a 442nd, what a great thing that would be. It would have been for everybody. Every time I see one, I don't care if I saw him yesterday and I see him again today, it's like another new beginning, you know. I look at him and say, wow, this is one of the guys that the reason I'm maybe standing here today. Maybe we would have gotten out of it. We never know. But as far as I'm concerned, they were our saviors. And they deserve every little hello or thank you that they can get.
And in 2011, they received another big thank you. All Nisei veterans of World War II were honored with the Congressional Gold Medal, the complete opposite end of the spectrum from the way Americans of Japanese ancestry were treated 70 years earlier. Let's get a final piece of perspective today from the Purple Heart and Bronze Star recipient we heard from earlier, Lawson Sakai.
Well, you know, the whole country is formed by immigrants. So it's pretty hard to say one group of immigrants can say we're American, but you immigrants are not Americans. You know, that doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that correction was a huge step in forming the United States. It's just something that had to be recognized. And in 1941... this whole country was run by the East Coast people. And a lot of those people, including President Roosevelt, had very little knowledge or contact with Asian people at that point, because almost all of us were on the West Coast, and the East Coasters didn't want to mingle with the savages on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, it was like, oh, those animals out in the West Coast, you know. So I think the war did bring both sides together. East went west, west went east, and things changed a lot. I think we did what we intended to do. I'm sorry that, like my parents and all the other Issei who are now all gone, didn't really live long enough to capitalize on what we had gotten for them. 1952, I believe, they were allowed to become naturalized citizens of the United States. You know, a huge turnaround from deportation to naturalization, you know, and all because of what their children, the Nisei boys, did for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is very important to impress on, like, my children and their children, that they know that that first generation that was born here suffered along with their parents because they couldn't get jobs either. But by doing what they did, going to war and so forth, they, you know, they created the life for them that's so good.
Yeah.
Like, I have four children. They all graduated college. They're all doing good. I have seven grandchildren. They've all graduated college, and they're all doing good. You know, you couldn't have done that in 1941.
Well, none of them would have been born if you didn't survive the war. But, you know, I always end the show by saying freedom isn't free. And what you're saying is, for Japanese Americans, freedom and opportunity isn't free, that a lot of lives paid for it in World War II. Oh,
absolutely. Well, we've had a couple of generations since that have never had to go to war. And in 1941 and 2, the whole world was at war. We were either going to win or lose. And if we lost, We'd either be speaking German or Japanese.
The late Lawson Sakai, what an incredible advocate he was for his fellow veterans, and what a special friend to the USS Hornet. And one more time, all the veterans you heard from today are featured in that amazing Nisei Veterans exhibit aboard the USS Hornet in Alameda, California. You will not regret a visit to go check it out. They are open on the 4th of July from 10 to 5, and no matter when you visit, you'll see firsthand so many examples that underscore that reality we try to highlight each week, but seems maybe even a little more relevant than ever on Independence Day. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.